Good morning. First case today is U.S. v. Washington. Appellant ready to argue? The government? Okay. Appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, judges of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Zachary Gray. Together with Captain Catherine Godfrey, we represent the appellant, Private Tyler Washington. Chief Judge, if I may reserve 5 minutes for
granted.
Whatever peppercorn of relevance the sharp testimony had, it was substantially outweighed by the prejudice from the military judge permitting the prosecution to inform the panel that the Army expects that when someone says no or stop, it means no to anything and stop to everything. Of course, we understand that no certainly means no, but that's not the question at issue in this case. The question was, no as to what? And in this case, the sharp representative was allowed to answer that question, which was no means walk away. Again, no to anything and stop to everything. And this did two things. It eliminated the possibility that the panel could consider the context in which somebody said no, and it rejected the possibility that Private Washington had reasonably believed that Specialist AF had merely limited consent rather than fully revoked that consent.
Captain Gray, why did it have the effect of eliminating the ability for the panel members to consider the entire context?
Judge Olson, because it was posed in a categorical, effectively a categorical and a normative best practice, the sharp representative said when someone says no, it means stop and walk away.
Did the sharp representative testify to that or something slightly different in terms of this is what the training was, not this is the standard, this is not what the command requires, this is not what is the reasonable standard, but instead this is what they were instructed on?
That's correct. He did say the training included a slide. It was specifically said that it included a slide that told the soldiers when someone says no, it means to stop and walk away. We think that the effective message, especially in this case, where the sharp representative was testifying and providing evidence to the panel, that he served as a conduit for the prosecution to remind the panel members that the senior-most members of the military who designed the SHARP program and the instruction are saying that this is what we expect of soldiers. And I think particularly in a hierarchical organization like the one that we operate in, when we instruct our soldiers that if X, then Y, when a soldier doesn't do Y, there is a knee-jerk, almost, reaction to that, which is to say the soldier doesn't abide by the instruction that we provide them, then that soldier's in the wrong. And that roughly translates to that soldier was negligent, was unreasonable.
Hey, Captain Gray, let me ask you this. Didn't the SHARP training issue come up during voir dire?
It did, Your Honor. Joint Appendix, page 19.
Right. So is your problem how far the witness testified about, how much he testified about the SHARP training, or could he, or are you saying he shouldn't have testified at all about anything about SHARP training? In other words, what if he'd just gone up and said, hey, look, that's the accused over there. He was 5 days before the incident. He was in my SHARP training class. I'm a certified SHARP instructor, period. What about that?
Your Honor, under those circumstances,
I know he didn't say that. He said more than that. But which is your problem? That he testified at all about this, or that you think he testified too much about the SHARP training?
The principal problem is that it was far, far too much. I think it's a different question if they had merely called the SHARP representative to say, I'm the rep and he attended my class. I think then you potentially have other issues with respect to cumulative. I don't know that it necessarily makes any fact more or less likely. Everybody in the Army attends SHARP training quarterly, so I'm not sure.
Wasn't the key issue here that the government was trying to show that he attended training only 5 days before the incident?
I think that may have been part of it.
I'll ask them when they get up there. You don't need to theorize on their motives.
No, but you are correct. We believe that the prejudice here comes significantly from what precisely that sharp rep was permitted to testify. I think if we want to look back,
let me stop there first before you. The standard for this kind of an issue would be a substantial influence on the findings, right?
Substantial impact on the burden, on the outcome, Your Honor.
On the outcome. And so, I mean, that's a fairly, not a real high standard, but it's a fairly high standard, right? So your claim is that the fact that this witness testified as they did created a substantial impact on the members?
Yes, Your Honor, we believe that certainly. And I think this court need only look to the context, which was what made this so important. You have two junior soldiers who'd been in the Army for literally months. We have a continuing 20 to 30 minute consensual intimate relationship where there's actually a break and the victim or specialist AF then returns and they re-engage in further intimate contacts. You have specialist AF who admitted that she was the one who took her shirt off on both occasions. You have the instance where she says, no, or I'm uncomfortable. And I'll point out for the court, I think if you look to pages 67 and 107 of the joint appendix, you'll find two instances where it's unclear at best as to whether she says stop or whether she says I'm uncomfortable, whether she says them both, or whether she is using those as a euphemism for what she actually told law enforcement, which was that she would be loud or noisy. So you have this continuing intimate sexual contact. You have her saying, stop, or I'm uncomfortable, maybe, but unequivocally saying that she said she would be loud or noisy, after which he places his hand over her mouth, continues to kiss down her stomach, and she admits that she never tried to remove his hand from her mouth.
But doesn't the record there then potentially dilute the effect of the sharp representative's testimony? It's not a situation now where it is so clearly 1 + 1 = 2, or connect the dots, to use a different analogy. It's not where the victim clearly testified, I said stop. And then the sharp representative says, I gave training. Stop means walk away. There's all this different indication based on the CID witness testimony and so forth about exactly what she said, so it's not as clear connected dots, is it?
Your Honor, I think the problem is all of those facts, that litany of things that we just identified that injected ambiguity, those were all of the context. And the problem with this testimony was principally that the standard was that the Army says, if somebody says stop, you are to completely disengage and to walk away. So it invited the panel to set all of those facts aside and to say, hey, sorry, Private Washington, she said no or stop, and we train you precisely what you're supposed to do. You didn't do that. That's inherently unreasonable. But I think really the clincher for this was the structure of the prosecution's argument, which was to hammer away at the fact that she said no or stop. You look from pages 146 to 149 in just three pages of the joint appendix, you have references to no or stop 12 times. Then during closing in six pages from 160 to 166 of the joint appendix, you have another 26 references to no or stop. And then when the defense puts on their argument and says, she may very well have said no, but he may have reasonably believed that she had merely limited consent, that's when you have the prosecution come back on rebuttal and tell the panel that the quote-unquote number one consideration over whether Private Washington was reasonable was the fact that he had been trained by his unit in the week prior, essentially inviting the panel to apply the standards articulated from the sharp representative.
Is it your position that I'm not putting words in your mouth, but that under 403, you've got dueling instruction that this amounted to a statement of law by the Sharp representative, which could confuse the members?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. It is. I think there are two variations on that argument, though, that I wanted to...
I mean, he's not saying the law is X, but he's saying, I trained him, and we told him that.
That's correct.
Right.
And the panel could confuse that. I also think there is a related, but not identical, problem where, again, referencing the hierarchical nature of the military, which is the prospect that the panel turns this from a 120 case into an Article 92 case. In other words, they stop considering whether or not Private Washington reasonably believed that Specialist AF had merely limited consent, and instead start thinking about, did Private Washington abide by this instruction? Now, I get those are two very related arguments, but they are, at least to my eyes, analytically distinct, and I think they stack with one another to really fully articulate the ways in which, under a straightforward 403 balancing test, this resulted in both unfair prejudice and confusion of the issues.
Counsel, this is a very important case because, as you point out, everyone in the Army receives sharp training, and so the question may come up in future cases about whether a sharp representative may testify. Suppose that the sharp representative had given training that was exactly what you say in your brief. Sometimes stop means completely disengage, and sometimes it means just cease a particular activity with limiting the consent, but not removing the consent altogether. In other words, suppose he had been trained completely accurately, and maybe the defense wanted to bring that in. Is it are you saying that at one point in your brief you say sharp training has no place in the trial, but what if it is a correct statement of the law?
Your Honor, if it's a correct statement of the law and we're talking, we believe that it could be relevant to the subjective reasonableness of one's belief. So to the effect that, taking this out of the sharp category, but if this was a anti-drug abuse lecture, and the trainer said using marijuana in the military is illegal, and then you had an unlawful ingestion case, and you wanted to call said trainer to say he was at this training and we told him that marijuana ingestion was unlawful. We think that there are certain circumstances where it could go to subjective intent.
Well, counsel, my difficulty is that it would be almost impossible for any statement of law to be completely correct. For example, the statement they gave, stop means stop, that is true, it's just not complete. And even with your example, you could still have an innocent ingestion defense. You could have a reasonable mistake of fact defense. And so, it's not that what he was told in sharp training was wrong so much as, like any statement of the law, by itself, unless it's a treatise, cannot be complete.
Yes, Your Honor, and as a best practice, I mean, going back to what this court, has said before, when the government chooses, or anyone for that matter, chooses to reference command policy, they have to tread lightly. And that was a theme from last term when this court heard Badeau. And I guess, because my time is winding up here, I think in a situation when you're dealing with training as relevant to reasonableness or a mistake of fact, if something is truly representative of a quote-unquote community standard, we don't think that the prosecution needs to remind anybody of it. So we think that the safest practice would be to largely advise the prosecution as well as the defense to allow sharp training to fulfill its function in terms of being a preventative training tool and to keep it out of the courtroom.
Do you quibble with the notion that because the military judge explored this issue, put a reasoning on the record, that her decision here is entitled to great deference by this court?
No, Your Honor. I understand that when a military judge articulates her basis, that typically it is it should receive greater deference. But the manner in which this judge looked at this, there were several issues that I think were just a misapplication of the law. She seemed to be applying or consider what was the age, experience, and training as relevant to the subjective component of mistake of fact, when that is in fact just modifying elements to the objective component. So to the degree that that itself was an improper invocation of the law, we think that it should be accorded less deference than would otherwise be afforded. Chief, I see that I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, judges of the court, may it please the court, my name is Captain Christopher Layden, and along with Major Hannah Kaufman, I represent the United States. This court should affirm the judgment of the Army Court because the military judge did not abuse her discretion when she admitted relevant evidence under MRE 403 to show that appellant's belief, his theory, that stop meant keep going was neither reasonable nor honest.
Was it admitted for that purpose, or was it admitted simply to show that somebody had instructed him to that effect?
Your Honor, it was simply admitted to rebut the defense raised, because it went to both prongs. It was relevant.
Well, part of was it even relevant under 401? Does the fact that he was trained have anything to do with anything other than we filled a block on the piece of paper or the computer?
It is relevant, Chief Judge Stuckey. It's relevant because it goes to both prongs to show that not only the reasonable soldier, but this particular soldier, were disabused of the notion which he wanted the panel to believe, which is that stop.
Well, to take a leaf from my brother Mags, it's not necessarily what he was told was not necessarily correct and certainly not complete. So what are we left with, especially in the case where the judge said, I'm going to instruct on this, and then the judge didn't. And so you've got what purports to be, seems to me, a statement of law from this lay witness and the judge who's supposed to give them the law, and they're both floating out there in front of the members.
Your Honor, the government respectfully disagrees with that characterization of how this evidence was introduced, used, and received by the members. There's no indication.
How do you know how it was used by the members?
Well, what we know is that there's no indication from a fair reading of the record that it was used that way. We know that, as in all courts martial, this military judge instructed the panel early and often, I give the law. There's one standard here. She did that in the beginning. The issue was voir dire. The panel members are told during voir dire, if you have any questions.
She promised an instruction that she didn't give.
Your Honor, I'm not sure that she promised it. I think she said
she said, I'm going to instruct up and down about this, so you just be calm, defense counsel. And then when the time came, she gave the stock instruction on mistake of fact, and she gave the instruction on I give you the law.
That's correct, Chief Judge Stuckey. But
right.
Also during that conversation where amended, additional, tailored instructions were solicited from the defense, they refused the opportunity.
They'd already been promised it.
Well, that was the opportunity to say if their contention, their belief was that was, in fact, a promise, that was coming, that was the opportunity to solicit that, I imagine, because the judge said,
okay.
Now that the evidence has come
out. So here you are. Here you're the members, and you're sitting here, and the judge says the law is yakety-yakety-yak. And then you have Mr. Sharp over here saying, well, we the Army instructed this guy, and I check the records, and he was there, that da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Your Honor, if I'm the panel member, I was actually specifically told in the beginning that the judge will give the law. I was asked if I thought my sharp training would interfere and bleed over into what the law would be, and then at the end, I am, in fact, given the law. And I think what happened here is the panel members were not confused. They asked no questions about this. And this case, importantly, Your Honor, this isn't a situation where the government came into the courtroom waving the bloody flag of sharp. This is a situation where they proved their case overwhelmingly so. And then when the defense was raised, a burden was transferred on them to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that was not a reasonable, not an honest mistake of fact. And so they used the evidence that they had prepared to use and that they had a ruling outside of the presence of the members would come in for that purpose. And they used it in that limited effect and that tailored use. And what I think is important, Your Honor, is that no one credited that information. The witness did not say, and this is, hey, we all know this is the law. And the government certainly didn't argue that it was the law. The government didn't even mention this at all in its closing argument. It wasn't until the defense wholly hung their hat on the mistake of fact defense that in rebuttal they said, he's trained on this a week before. He was part of a conversation.
Well, the implication, they wholly hung their hat on mistake of fact. So then here comes the government and says, hey, he was trained by Sharp. What's the implication? The implication is he's wrong because Sharp is right, and therefore it's a proper statement of the law.
Your Honor, I would disagree with that, and I would argue that the use of the evidence was to say,
I'm just trying to get at what's going on here.
I understand. And I think the use of the evidence was to say, he has now put forth this theory that, from my prior experience, I think stop means keep going. And this evidence had strong rebuttal force to show that not only all reasonable soldiers, reasonable young soldiers, which is the objective standard here, it's what would a reasonable young soldier.
Well, that's not necessarily what they're maintaining. He's not saying stop means go. It seems to me he's saying stop in this context, when she had discussed noise, may have meant something else.
Well, the government's position, Your Honor, is that when he expressed that notion, when that was his case to the panel, this is my belief, and it's honest and it's reasonable. The government could not have its hands tied behind its back when it had evidence that days before, he, like all soldiers, are disabused of that notion. And that was a limited use of the evidence. And
so wait. Disabused of this notion. If everybody in the Army has sharp training, then everybody in the Army is disabused of this notion. Then it follows that a mistake of fact defense is an illusion, doesn't it?
I disagree with that. The government's position is not that this court should, in its opinion, write out the mistake of fact defense. It is a completely valid defense. It is only when the defense makes
Well, no, you're saying that a mistake of fact defense comes up against the fact that they were trained, that everybody in the Army is trained in sharp, and the Army and everybody in the Army is shown this slide. It seems to me that has all kinds of penumbras and emanations, which I'd sooner not explore. But anyway, go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor, and there was no abuse of discretion, but even if there were, there was no material prejudice to appellant's substantial rights either. And so I'll begin with the standard review in this case, abuse of discretion.
Counsel, before we get to that, you've argued in your brief that the testimony of the sharp agent, sharp representative, was relevant to both whether his view was reasonable and whether it was honest, whether it was subjective. Appellant argues in its briefs that at trial you only argued that it was relevant to what a reasonable person would consider, and I guess the suggestion is that we can't consider whether it might be relevant to the subjective belief. What's the government's response to, if I'm correctly characterizing the appellant's brief, what's the government's response to that?
Government's response is that the record clearly shows that it went to both. The judge at the 39A indicated it went to both, and in the rebuttal argument where this information was referenced, it was referenced specifically as his belief was, quote, not honest and was not reasonable. That was the language used in rebuttal. So everyone was on the same page, the government and the military judge. This went to both, and it was argued that way in a limited fashion. And so when we look at an abuse of discretion, we understand that that occurs only where the military judge makes findings of fact that are clearly erroneous or conclusions of law that are incorrect. And here, None of that happened because the military judge, after thoughtfully balancing the 403 equities on the record, concluded that this was probative because it went to both aspects, subjective and objective. And as I've indicated, the objective standard is that of a reasonable person and under the totality of the circumstances present. And the circumstances present in this case create a standard of a reasonable young soldier of similar age, experience, and education. This evidence countered the proposition that a reasonable young soldier would think stop, man, keep going. That a reasonable young soldier would literally silence a girl he was having an intimate encounter with the moment he heard the thing he didn't want to hear. And she said, stop, I'm uncomfortable, three times. His response was to put his hand over her mouth and proceed. This evidence was powerful to rebut the subjective component because this individual, again, not the reasonable standard anymore, this individual was present for and participating in a discussion on consent revocability days before this happened. And so this evidence was offered simply, whatever weight the panel wanted to assign, it was for them to decide, but this was submitted as evidence to rebut that because it did both.
Counsel, can we go back to the objective component? How is what something was told to the individual accused relevant to what a reasonable person would think? I mean, it seemed it could go to what he subjectively thought, but what's reasonable does not depend on what was said in one day in one sharp class to one group of soldiers.
Yes, Judge Max, and it's relevant to the objective standard because all soldiers experience this training. And it's relevant to show that all
soldiers... Was that the testimony that everybody had been told the same thing? Wasn't the testimony just that he had been told that? Or his class?
The testimony, and it's less than 10 pages in the entire record, it's that on a particular day training was given, he knows the appellant was there because he didn't want his new guys falling asleep in the back. So he was actually up there reading slides, part of the conversation. And one of those slides, again, he does not credit or define or vouch for the definition. He says, one of the slides says stop means no means stop, walk away. And then he sat down and he was cross-examined. And so this wasn't there to show that the objective standard is the sharp standard. The accuracy of the information isn't the issue. It isn't what makes it important. What makes the training important is the fact that the soldier was there just days before part of it and then had the audacity to suggest, oh, I really honestly and reasonably thought stop meant keep going. And that's exactly what the government used it for. I think it's also important to point out that when we look at a 403 analysis, some federal courts have said we give the challenged evidence its maximum reasonable probative value and its minimum reasonable prejudicial impact. And so what we have here is the defense challenging this under 403 as confusing and unduly prejudicial. This information was not confusing in the context of the court-martial, where one standard and only one standard was issued. The opportunity to clear the air on that was given to everyone, including the panel members and the defense. No additional instruction was requested. The appropriate instruction was then given, and then the evidence was argued in a limited and tailored fashion. This was also not unduly prejudicial, and that, again, bleeds back into the limited use of the evidence. It's because the government did not come in and open with this, did not have the sharp representative vouch for or credit the information briefed. What they did was they had this in their back pocket as a contingency because they saw over the horizon this is what the defense is probably going to do. And so this wasn't even part of the government's case in chief until it became abundantly clear this was the defense. And the government had an obligation then to rebut that defense, and that's what it did in a fair manner. And that's why we have MRE 403, and that's why we have an abuse of discretion. And the judge carefully articulated her reasoning on the record. Turning to prejudice, even assuming there was an abuse of discretion, there was no prejudice of any substantial right because the government did not need this witness to secure its conviction, did not use it as a centerpiece of its case, did not even produce it as more than an afterthought in the court-martial. This is a case where and when we look at a non-constitutional error standard and we look at material prejudice, we look to four things: the strength of the government's case, the strength of the defense's case, and the materiality and quality of the evidence. In this case, the government had the victim, and she testified credibly, according to the panel, and it didn't stand alone. This wasn't a he said, she said. This is a case where the victim testified, and she was corroborated not only by the intervening soldier in the next room, who hears the ruckus, who hears appellant trying to shush her. But we have her real-time text messages to the soldier where she says, help, I said stop, and he kept going. But most importantly, we have the appellant's own words. We have his own words where he establishes three things. She did say stop. He did hear it, and he did keep going. That's what proved the government's case. Turning to the second prong, the strength of the defense's case, they presented no case at all. Why appellant and his
brief, they what?
They produced no case. They presented no case in chief, Your Honor. While appellant suggests that posits a proof of weakness of the government's case, that's as unavailing as it is unsupported by the law. It was their choice to present nothing at all but this defense. And quality and materiality, this evidence was only used to counter an already shaky defense. And so we have no abuse of discretion. We have no abuse of discretion. We have no attempt to define a term, submit a new standard beyond what the military judge provided, and there's no confusion. There's no confusion at all, and this evidence probatively countered a claim, and for those reasons, we ask the court to affirm the judgment of the Army Court. Pending any further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal.
Chief Judge, I'd like to take some of my time to briefly talk through the government's assessment of the prejudice stemming from this case, because we think that there is a different way to characterize precisely what happened, especially applying the four-factor Kerr analysis. With respect to the strength of the relative cases, this was a close case. And in fact, both of the parties agreed on almost everything. So everything that the government just got up and told you with respect to the text messages, what they proved, what they demonstrated, that was effectively conceded at this trial. They did not contest that she said no, that he at least, or no or stop, that he at least heard her. They introduced those text messages. They couldn't contest that. The single piece of evidence the single material issue was whether or not he reasonably believed that this may have been a limitation on consent rather than a revocation on consent. I think one of the conflations that the government makes is to continue pressing the idea that this was about no means keep going. And that's not our position. And it has never been our position throughout the entire briefs. The question is, does this no mean that she has limited her consent to that which will not make her loud? In other words, has limited her consent to that things other than oral sex? Or was it a complete revocation of consent? And when that statement about I'm uncomfortable, stop or I'm uncomfortable, is couched in a concern that she will be loud or noisy, it injects a genuine question with respect to whether Private Washington was reasonable when he continued not with performing oral sex. There was no evidence. And if you look, I apologize, the joint appendix is at page 102, the victim concedes. He didn't try and take her pants off. He didn't unbutton them. He didn't put his hands inside her pants. All he continued doing was entirely consistent with the understanding that when she said no or stop, it was limited to whether or not he could perform oral sex on her.
Then why put his hand over her mouth? Why was there nothing here of asking her when she says no or I'm uncomfortable?
Your Honor,
clarification of what she meant by that.
And just like Sharp, perhaps it would have been a best practice for him to say, may I put my hand over your mouth? We also don't think that it is so inherently unreasonable for somebody in those circumstances to think that because somebody had been concerned about their friend next door hearing them engaging in oral sex, that he put his hand over her mouth. There is a question as to whether or not that was objectively reasonable. I'm not saying, and in essence, the Sharp training answered that question. It told the panel that No. The standard for soldiers is that when somebody says no or stop, it's to do precisely what you're saying, Judge Olson, which is to stop, disengage, and say, you know, please define further. Would you like me to continue kissing some or not at all? And maybe that's a best practice. Perhaps it is. But is it? Does that define what the reasonably prudent person does under those circumstances? We don't think so, and we think it was entirely too likely the panel, however, was going to adopt this standard. Last point is that the government focused or spent considerable time talking about this being a minor piece of the prosecution's case. And if this court looks at the structure of this entire trial, the prosecution really set up a syllogism. It was, she said no, and again, we have it, you know, 42 times over the course of closing and opening, which is just 9 pages of text. It was just basic reiterations of the fact she said no or stop. And then when the defense, after seeing their witness get cross-examined and have to admit that she wasn't sure what precisely she told CID, and if you go back to Joint Appendix at 107, I think there's a useful conversation where she admits that she's not sure exactly what words she used, but she does admit she said she was loud. I think I lost my train of thought there, Your Honors. Pending further questions, I see that I'm running out of time. Oh, to conclude, we ask that this court set aside the findings and sentence in this case. Thank you very much.
Chief, thank you. I hate John. To prolong this, but I do have one question. On the prejudice issue, during voir dire, the members all agreed that whatever sharp training they had received, they would put it aside, and they would obey the instructions of the military judge on the law. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, then why wouldn't they do the same thing if they heard testimony from this lay witness about consent or what have you, or whatever one can draw from the sharp instructor's testimony? Why wouldn't they simply do the same thing and say, hey, look, we understand what that sharp instructor is saying about consent, but we agreed to follow the military judge and his or her instructions on the law?
Your Honor,
why can't we presume that?
Because they were told explicitly otherwise. If you look to the Joint Appendix at page 19, the very first instruction that the military judge gave here was that you will not consult essentially extra trial materials unless admitted into evidence. And that's part of what made this so prejudicial, is then they admitted that very testimony, and it would be reasonable for the panel here to think, I was supposed to disregard Sharp, but the military judge has now injected it into trial. And we think that it's worthwhile for this court to consider that during voir dire, the trial counsel expressly disclaimed Sharp and made sure that nobody would take it into account. And yet when they see their case after finishing their case in chief, what do? They decide to call as their very last witness the Sharp trainer himself to talk about Sharp training. And you just can't reconcile those two concepts. For that reason, we ask that, again, you would set aside the findings and sentence.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Chief Judge.
Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted. Court is in recess until 10:25.